We're up to the book of Shmuel. You know, the Christians divided the book of Samuel into Samuel A and Samuel B. It's a Christian invention.
How do they get around to doing that?
What?
How do they get around to doing that?
That's a good question. But that's not our class tonight. We're nearing the end of what they call Samuel A. Let's quickly recap from the beginning till here. So, the world was created in 7 days, 10 generations from Adam to Noah. Then we have the flood, 10 generations to Abraham. And Abraham is born in the year 1948, 1,948 years from creation. Abraham has a son, Isaac, and a boy from the maid, Ishmael. Isaac has a son, Yaakov, and a twin brother. Yaakov has a twin brother, Esav. Yaakov has 12 children. They go down to Egypt, and they leave Egypt in the year 2448, right? So we leave Egypt. We spend 40 years in the desert, 2488. We enter Israel under Joshua with the splitting of the Jordan. We enter Israel, 7 years conquering Israel, 7 years dividing Israel. Joshua dies, and we have the period of the judges. A few hundred years under the judges, which were like kings, only they weren't really kings. There wasn't a direct lineage. It wasn't that son took over after father. It wasn't that they had unlimited power like a king. But nonetheless, they were our leaders. And so we have the period of the judges. And then after the judges, we have the final prophet, Shmuel. He's probably the final judge. And the people of Israel tell him, we want a king. So he turns to God. And it's understood that it comes from a bad place. The people want a king as an excuse, as a way of distancing themselves from God. They think they'll get away with more sins under a king. But God says, fine, and he gives them a king from the tribe of Benjamin named Saul. And Saul is very tall and very powerful and exceptionally humble. Saul is already a relatively old man. I mean, he has a son who's 38 years old, so he couldn't have been too young. And nonetheless, we find Saul helping his father, Kish, when he's chosen as king. So Saul seems to be a very faithful son. Now, most of Benjamin has been wiped out in a civil war that took place a few years earlier, and after the whole story of Pelegish Begiva with the concubine on the hilltop. And now Saul is anointed as our first king. He leads us to fantastic wars, but he has two sins. Number one, the prophet tells him to wait before attacking the enemy, wait till the prophet comes and brings the sacrifice. And the war seems like it's about to begin. So Saul does not wait. He brings the sacrifice on his own. And that's strike number one, where he doesn't listen to the prophet. Strike number two is when they go to war against Amalek and he doesn't finish the job. He leaves a lot of people living and animals living from Amalek. And he is told that he will lose the throne. He has a son-in-law, David. David from the tribe of Judah, descendant of Boaz, descendant of Ruth. David is his son-in-law. He's married his daughter. And David is highly successful. And Saul recognizes that David will take the throne from him. And so Saul decides that David is rebellious. And he takes his men in pursuit of David, trying to kill him. And after repeated attempts, he is unsuccessful. God doesn't want David to die. But at one point, David realizes that he's never going to make peace with his father-in-law, Saul. There's nothing he could do to prove to his father-in-law that he really wants peace with him. After twice being able to kill Saul and proving it to him and telling him, look, I could have killed you and I didn't. I want peace with you. He sees that nothing's going to work, and so he realizes he must go into the enemy territory, and he sends word to the Philistine king, Achish, and tells him, I want to make peace with you. I've had it with the Jewish people. Me and my men will come and we'll help you. And Achish is very happy with the opportunity. He takes David into the capital, and then David tells him, why should I burden you with my 600 men here? You know, it's costing you a lot of money to feed all of us. Let us go and we'll take care of ourselves. So Achish gives David an area where he can live with his men. And David is there with his family. And every few days they go to war. And there's a whole territory near the south of Israel, near the tribe of Judea, with nations that are enemy nations to the people of Israel. But they're living quietly. They're not attacking us. So every few days, David would go and attack and finish off another nation, come back with the loot, send some to the tribe of Judah, and some to Achish, the Philistine king. And he'd send it with a message to Achish. Today I attacked the Jews over here and brought you back some loot. Today I attacked the Jews over there and brought you back some more loot. Now that's a lie, right? He didn't attack the Jews, he attacked other nations that were surrounding Israel territory. But Achish is unaware of that, and Achish is fully confident that David is fed up with the Jewish people. He's sure that David keeps on attacking the Jews, and so he has full confidence in David. Now, we have to remember that David's claim to fame was his wars against the Philistines. Until this point, David had scored tremendous wins against the Philistines. But now Achish is convinced that David is on his side. And the day comes when the Philistines go to war against Israel. Saul is terribly frightened of this war. And he's correct to be frightened because he is about to die at this war. God tells Saul that he and his children will die if he goes to war. And, okay, through the prophet Shmuel, etc., we're skipping the details.
That's a pretty good reason to be scared.
That's a good reason to be scared. And Achish, with the other Philistine leaders, there are five heads of the Philistines, they're going out to war, and then the other leaders tell Achish, what are you doing bringing these Jews along? This is the way the Jews can make up with their men again. If they turn on us in the middle of the war, that's the best way David could join forces with the Jews again. So Achish tells David, look, I like you, I trust you, but the rest of the leaders here, they don't. So do me a favor, don't make an issue. Get up at the crack of dawn, get out of here so we don't have a fight. And David starts arguing with them and saying, did I do anything wrong? Have you found me anything less than faithful? And Achish says, no, of course I trust you. There's nothing I can do. Do me a favor. I apologize. There's nothing we can do. I would have wanted you as my personal guard in this war, but there's nothing we can do. So, okay, David makes a show, and he's saved from this situation. He takes his men and heads back to Ziklag. He comes to Ziklag on the third day, only to discover that while he was away, Amalek came. Amalek understood what he was doing, and Amalek said, we're not waiting till he attacks us. They came and attacked him, and they conquered all his wives, all his children, and they burned down the place. And he and his men come back to Ziklag to discover their wives are gone, their children are gone, their camp is burnt to a crisp, and there's nothing there. And they don't know if anyone's left living or not. And at that point, the nation starts weeping, David and his men, and they're weeping so terribly, they have no more strength. And then, at that time, the nation starts talking, let's kill David, it's all his fault. And he's standing there and he hears his men talking about a serious rebellion. People are very upset. Their wives and children are gone. And this is where we left off. And here is the pasuk that most resonates with me in Tanakh. It says that things looked so bad. Think about it. We are in Shmuel, Samuel, what they call Samuel A, the 30th chapter, the 6th pasuk. So it says, Vateitzer le David meot. David was greatly distressed. The people wanted to stone him. The people were so embittered over their children and their sons and daughters. And now comes to my mind, the key words, Vaitchazek David Bashem Elokav. David strengthened himself and Hashem is God. So many times life seems to have turned against us. People are faced with challenges that they seem insurmountable. And in my life, whenever things seemed so tough, I always remember this pasuk. This is the pasuk that most speaks to me. Because it reminds me that even David had moments when he was down. One of the things that personally, in my avodas Hashem, frustrates me is when things are challenging and they're not going the way I want. So I would expect my first thought would be to pray, to turn to God. And somehow when things are really seriously bad, when things are really frustrating, I'm not talking about little things, I'm talking about big things, I always find that in my life there's an evolvement. I cannot just go from the hardship to prayer. I have to work on myself to get into that prayer. And then I can connect to the prayer and through the prayer connect to Hashem. But it doesn't happen on autopilot. Meaning there's an evolvement. There's a work in progress where I have to think about it and push myself and go and daven. You know, and not just do the lip service, not just say the Shemona Esrei. And I think that's part of Vayitchazek David Bashem Elokav. David strengthened himself and Hashem is God. That's one of the things a Jew should always remember. When things are tough, so then that's when I have to strengthen myself, my connection to Hashem. And if we've mentioned this on Sunday nights, we're supposed to have the Jewish home class. So you should just know that the same is true also in marital relationships. I've seen couples that had an autistic child, that had a handicapped child, that had all kinds of issues. And I've seen couples separate over this. And the truth is, it's hard. Medical issues are a real strain on the relationship. But every hardship can be a source of friction, and it inevitably will be. But it can also be a source of connection. If people approach it correctly, and people decide, we're not going to let this destroy our relationship. We're going to come out of this stronger. I'm going to take that extra step towards my spouse. It's not easy. You know, it's easier said than done. Much easier said than done. But a person has to know that it has potential in both directions. Okay, so David asks Evyasar, the Kohen. Remember, David has the only Kohen around right now, because the other Kohanim were murdered by Saul's men. And he says, okay, let's ask God. And David asked God, should I chase after this battalion? Will I reach them? And ordinarily we do not ask God two questions at once. You ask one, you get the answer, and then you ask the second. But here they were under pressure. They didn't know if the Amalekim were killing their children as they were speaking. So he asked both questions at once, and he gets both answers. God says, chase, you will reach them, and you will save the families. And David takes his 600 men. And they're running as fast as they can. They reach a river called Nachal Besor. And 200 men say, we can't hack this. We can't keep going at this pace. And so he continues with the 400 men. He leaves 200 behind to guard their stuff. We're up to the 11th verse in the 30th chapter. And as they're running, they find a sickly person, an Egyptian slave on the field. And they give him to eat and they give him to drink. Remember, they're in a rush. Right, but they're humane. So they give the man to eat and drink, and they give him some dried fruits, and then he's rejuvenated. He hadn't eaten for 3 days. And David asks him, tell us, who are you? Where are you from? And he says, I was a servant to the Amaleki, but I became sick, so he left me by the wayside to die. Gives us some insight as to who Amalek is. Now, we attacked that area to the south of Judah, and we burnt down Ziklag. And David says, will you show me the way to that battalion? And the Egyptian slave says, promise me by God that you won't kill me or give me in the hands of my master. I'll take you down. Pretty interesting. He thinks he can argue with his captor, right? David standing there with an army. But you see how humanely they treated him. So he takes them down. And what they see is that Amalek is sitting there eating and drinking and partying over all the loot that they took from the Philistines and Judea. And David attacks, and he attacks them at an unnatural time. Ordinarily, people would wage their wars by daytime because they didn't have lights, right? David doesn't wait. He attacks them mehaneshif, from twilight, from the dusk, through the night until the morning. And no one escapes. The only ones that escaped were 400 young men who could ride on camels. And David has rescued everything they took, and no one was hurt. All the children were retrieved, all the families were retrieved, and they've captured a lot of cattle, a lot of stuff from the Amalekim. Now remember, Amalek didn't attack him alone. They attacked Judea as well. So David comes back with his men to the 200 men. Remember, there were 200 men who couldn't keep up.
How many died?
I don't know of, as far as I know, none. David firstly asked them, how are you guys all doing? Now, among David's men, so there were some evil people. Remember, David's men weren't such high class. David initially had a group of, a band of people who were misfits. Each one had their debt, each one had their social issues. So some of the people said, you know, these guys didn't come and fight the war, they're not getting from the loot, and we'll give them back their wives, their children, their stuff, but why should they get from the loot? And David says, no, that's not right. We're all brothers here, and what Hashem's given us, we divide equally among the army. And that's a rule that David instituted. It's a rule that really Abraham instituted, that those people who guard our home, who guard our wares, while we go out to war, they get an equal portion in the loot. And then David sends from the lute to the tribe of Judea. And with that, we conclude our story of David. While David was fighting his wars against Amalek, at the very same time, the Philistines continue advancing towards Israel. And they attack. And Israel loses the war. And Saul and his son Jonathan are on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistine archers have located them. And they start shooting arrows at them nonstop. Now, Saul's strength and Benjamin's strength was in archery. The tribe of Benjamin were the most powerful archers and stone throwers. And Saul sees that he's finished. That the arrows keep whizzing by and he's wounded. And he knows he's going to die. And he turns to his arms bare and he says, "Draw your sword and kill me. Because if these fellows come here, they'll torture me to death." And the arms bearer was scared; he wasn't willing to do it. And so David took his sword, Shaul took his sword. Shaul was exceptionally tall; he had an exceptionally long neck. His head was above everyone else's head. He was taller than everyone. He had an exceptionally long neck. And we find in Tanakh, different people were blessed with different things, and every one of them ended up losing by it. Saul had an exceptionally long neck. He will now throw his neck on his sword and commit suicide. And from this whole saga, we learn many laws of euthanasia. Because Saul knew he would die anyways, so it was permissible to do what he did. He knew it was only a matter of minutes till they would catch him. Saul knew that otherwise he would die a more painful death. They would torture him to death. Saul was already wounded. He knew he would die. So many halachot of the idea of do not resuscitate, etc., are learned actually from this story of Saul. And Saul and his three major sons who were fighting at war with him, they all died together that day as God had forewarned him. And the Jews run. And the Philistines take his body, they hack off his head, they undress him, and they start, Shaul and his sons, and they hang his body for everyone to see. Look, they were victorious. And, yes.
So it's like you said, essentially suicide, right? This is a pretty harsh era.
So I'm saying, from here we learn. But he also knew he was dead. Meaning there was no question whether he would die. There was a question of whether he'd be tortured to death or not. So there are many details, but I'm saying this is one of the sources.
Was there any details of Jonathan and Jonathan's?
I am unaware. I am unaware of details. So remember, the people of Yavesh Gilad had a special relationship with the tribe of Benjamin. When there was a civil war, they were the only locale that would not attack the tribe of Benjamin. And when Saul became king, his first battle was actually to protect the people of Yavesh Gilad. So they travel throughout the night into Philistine territory, and they take down the body of Saul and his children, and they bring them to burial. They give them a proper burial. And they fast for 7 days. And David is in Ziklag, and suddenly a man comes to him, and his clothing are torn. He has earth on his head. He comes and bows before David, and David asks him, "Where are you coming from?" And he says, "I've come from the camp of Israel. I have fled." And David asks him, "What happened?" And the man says, "Everyone ran, and so many people died. And Saul and his son Jonathan, they're also dead." And David asks him, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan are dead?" And he says, "Well, I was there on Mount Gilboa. Saul was leaning on his spear. And the chariots, the horsemen, were catching up to him. He turned around, he saw me, and he said, 'Come here, come.' And I said, 'Yes, what do you want?' He asked me, 'Who, what nation are you from?' And I said, 'I'm an Amaleki.' And he said to me, 'Do me a favor, kill me, because I'm in the death throes already. And I'm still alive, but do me a favor, help me end it.' And I stood there, and I finished him off, because I knew he wouldn't live after that fool. And then I took his crown, and I took the bracelet he wore on his arm. I brought them here to my master." And he thinks that David will reward him, because, look, he's giving David the great news that his nemesis, Saul, is dead. And instead, what David does at that very moment, he grabs his clothing, he tears him in half, and he tears every garment he's wearing. The people with him tear their clothing. And David starts a eulogy, because he looks around, and he sees that people aren't so sad. Because actually, Saul was their archenemy. He was trying to kill them. So David begins a eulogy. And he starts speaking about how pious Saul and Jonathan were. What brave warriors they were. How much Saul would personally fund girls who were getting married. He would fund jewelry and give them beautiful clothing so that they'd go into the wedding dressed nicely. And so David speaks about the greatness of Saul and Jonathan. He says how he loved Jonathan more than the love between a man and a woman. And he says, how could it be that Saul on Mount Gilboa was killed? Mount Gilboa should be cursed, shouldn't have any more rain if Saul was taken down over there. Saul and Jonathan would never stop wielding their sword and their arrows. They're more loved in life and so pleasant in death. They're still with us. They are lighter than eagles. They are more brave than lions. Right? That's the famous line that's often written. Min sharim kalu ma'arayot gaveru. Okay, so after his eulogy, everyone's weeping. And then, David turns to him and says, who are you? So he says, well, my father's an Amaleki. He converted to Judaism. And David asks him, how'd you dare kill a king who was anointed by God? And David summons one of his lads and says, kill him. Because he testified that he himself killed the one who was anointed by God. Now, it's not clear whether the lad told the truth. We don't know. Some opinions say this is really what happened, and some opinions say no. He happened upon Saul dead, and he figured, let me make up the story so that I'll be rewarded by David. No one knows. But either way, David wasn't about to reward a person who says he killed Saul. He killed the one anointed by God. And then David asks God, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to go up to one of the cities of Judah, my own tribe? And God says, go. And then David asks, where should I go? And God tells him, go to Hebron. Why is it called Hebron? What's the root of the name Hebron? Chaver. Yes, Hebron is a place that's Chaver, reflects unity, friendship. Friendship between man and his fellow man, friendship between man and his creator. David goes up with his wives and his men, and they live in the cities of Hebron, and the people of Judah come to anoint him as king. And then David sends word to the people of Yavish, Gilead, blessing them for what they've done on behalf of Saul. Now David is trying to be politically savvy. If he wants to be accepted by Israel as king, then the best move he can do right now is get those who were most loyal to Saul to accept him. Who was most loyal to Saul? The people of Yavish Gilead. They just risked their lives to take back Saul's body and bury his body. So what does David do? After he's been accepted by his own tribe of Judea, he sends word to the people of Yavish Gilead and says, you guys are great. That's such an amazing thing you did, taking Saul's body back. Now I've been anointed by the tribe of Judah. You guys should be blessed. Why don't you come and accept me as your king? But it's not going to work. Because Saul's chief general, Abner ben Ner, his cousin, he was also Saul's cousin, he said, you know, when God blessed Benjamin, so Yaakov in his blessing of Benjamin with prophetic vision, he blessed him and said, Melachim echalatzecha yetzeu, you will have kings, plural. So Abner said, from the tribe of Benjamin, there was only one king, and God prophesied there'd be two. So it's not your turn yet, David. And with that, Abner ben Ner takes Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, a very pious person, and anoints him as king. And he first takes him to the eastern side of the Jordan, and he's accepted as king there. And then slowly he brings him into Israel, and he's accepted over all of Israel. So now Ish-bosheth, he's 40 years old, he's king over all of Israel. And the tribe of Judah is after David. And Abner ben Ner comes out, and Yoav goes out to meet him, and they're both standing there with their men by a pool of water. And Yoav looks at Avner's men, and he doesn't want a war. He realizes it's not a good idea now. And Avner turns to Yoav and says, why don't we let the lads joust? He's going to pay with his life for that sentence. Because he says, let them play a game, and we're going to see people are going to die in this game. And God says, what if you're playing a game with people's lives? You don't talk about people's lives as a game. And so they send 12 people from David's side, 12 people from Ish-bosheth, Avner's side, and each one has their sword. Each one grabs the other one by the head, and when they call out, each one takes their sword, kills the other one. Now, you got to think about what just happened. 24 people dropped dead. That sounds humorous, but it tells us something. Each one was more focused on killing the other one than protecting himself. Now, that's not usually the way you fight a battle. Usually your first thought is, let me protect me before you go and fight him. Before you want him dead, you want yourself protected. But this tells us something about the attitude in this war. You have Jew against Jew, and they're so focused on killing the other guy, they're not even protecting themselves. So 24 people drop dead. And with that, war breaks out. And this is where we'll pick up, Mizrach Hashem, next week, with the war between David's men and Avner's men.